Welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a little bit snarky about all things books. This is a brand new podcast, so if you like it, I'd really love your support. Please spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, and rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts. Let's get rolling. Hey everyone, welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. This week, I'm going to start out with a quick announcement before we get into our guest. If you have been reading my blog, you know that I have been toying with the idea of taking the podcast to a bi-weekly airing schedule for the summer instead of weekly. So that just means the podcast would air every other week rather than every week. And I wanted to let you all know that I have decided to move forward with that. And the reason is I absolutely love hosting this podcast. I feel like it's completely changed my life in the past year. And I can't thank you all enough for listening every single week. Your response has been totally overwhelming in the best way possible. However, it is a lot of work and I'm a one-woman show and I don't have an assistant to help me with everything. And I also run the blog. So once summer starts, my children will be out of school, obviously, and while I will have them in camps, it's a lot less hours than school, and the schedules are a lot more unpredictable. So I'm foreseeing some difficulty keeping up with the weekly airing schedule this summer. So I've decided to go to the bi-weekly schedule for June, July, and August, and don't worry, I'm not going anywhere. So starting at the end of May, you'll start to see biweekly podcasts. And I will remind you about this on every episode until this starts. Okay, on to our guest. This week, Allison from the blog Mind Joggle is joining me. At Mind Joggle, Allison writes about books, reading, writing, creativity, and learning. And I'd say she's pretty well known for her awesome book lists. At least I really love them. And in addition to writing Mind Joggle, Allison works part-time from home doing scientific and technical writing and website management in the government space. Welcome, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad you could join me today. And since Mother's Day is coming up this weekend, we are going to be talking a bit about being mothers, about the mental load that comes along with that, and Allison's book recommendations will focus on motherhood and books that might make great gifts for mothers. I love the name of your blog. Can you tell me a little bit about how you came up with that and what it means?
Oh, thanks. It's kind of a funny name, I think.
It's unique and it stands out.
Yeah. I knew when I started the blog that I wanted to write about books, but I wasn't sure if I wanted the blog to be solely about books. So I was kind of just looking for something that would give me room to expand into different areas, kind of the areas that you listed. And I came across this quote from a letter that Emily Dickinson had written to a friend. And the quote is, "He buys me many books, but begs me not to read them because he fears they joggle the mind."
I like that.
I kind of just like this quote for a lot of reasons. I kind of just like this idea of her father, who probably kind of noticed her genius, but was sort of just paying this, you know, lip service to his obligation to keep his daughter in her rightful place. You know, maybe she shouldn't be too educated, but I'm going to give you the books anyway. And here you go, you know, just please don't read them. And I just sort of like that mental image and the idea of, you know, shaking up your mind a little bit with books, because that's something that I guess it's a reason that I read. You know, I like to kind of challenge my mind and take it different places. So that's where that comes from.
That's a reason I read as well. And I love that maybe her father thought Mind Joggle was a negative term, whereas you're taking it in a very positive direction.
Yes, exactly.
A good shakeup.
Yeah.
I love that. And you started your blog to fill a void that being enmeshed in motherhood had sort of created. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I was kind of in this place in my life where I knew I wanted to do some more writing, some more reading. You know, I like creative writing, but it was sort of hard to get myself in that space of sitting down and writing a book or writing a story. But I was reading a lot. And I kind of thought that starting a blog would give me a way to do a little bit of writing, also maybe connect with some others who love the same things. I don't really have a lot of friends in real life who like to read. So It's always just been kind of a lone activity. I also was sort of just looking for a sense of personal accomplishment. I wanted something that I could create and, you know, hopefully excel at. That's not just work, not just part of family life, just kind of something for me. And I also kind of like how blogging is just sort of limitless. You can try things, you do whatever you want, and there's no real repercussions. And I can just see how I like it.
I totally understand what you're saying. I started my blog for virtually the same reason. And it came as somewhat a surprise to me that I might need to start a blog. So I obviously worked full-time right up until my son was born. And I thought I would be totally happy as a stay-at-home mom. And I wanted to do that. And then I quit my job and I stayed home with him for about a year without doing the blog. And I started to get a little restless. The mundanity, is that a word?
I think so. I know what you mean, though. Yeah.
The mundane, repetitive nature of being a stay-at-home mom, especially when your child is really, really young, it started to get to me. What blogging does for me is it gives me an identity, which I felt like I was losing. And I wanted to be more than just a mom, but also I wanted to be available for my kids a lot.
Yeah.
So this has enabled me to be flexible and available, but also have something of my own going on and something to think about and focus on, which also as a side benefit, I think pulls me out a little bit of the mom gossip.
Yes, exactly. And I knew that because I needed that outlet that pulled me away from the mom part of my life a little bit. You know, I wasn't going to go in and talk about parenting or talk about maintaining my home, or if I wanted something that I love.
Right. So you wrote a blog post that really got me thinking, and it was a long time ago that you wrote this, but I hear the term mental load all the time now. But my first memory of it really sinking in what that means and realization of like, yes, that is exactly what my life is like, was when I read your blog post, which was called Digging Out from Under the Mental Load. So can you tell us a little bit about this concept and what led you to write your blog post? And we'll link to the blog post in the show notes for everybody.
Yeah. So the mental load, I came across it maybe a couple of years ago, this idea of it. I think it's been around for a while, but it's this idea of the invisible workload is sort of another term for it. The mental cycling that happens to women mostly when they're maintaining a home and a family and now jobs and everything that goes with running lives that aren't just their own and managing all of these tiny little tasks that need to happen to make things work perfectly. When you're doing the tasks, most of them are pretty unimportant in the grand scheme of things, but they're what keeps lives going, right? And they're all these tiny little things that need to be remembered.
Yep.
And I just was feeling that a lot. That's where my brain was all of the time, just cycling through the million tiny little things. You know, where are my kids' socks? Where are their favorite stuffed animals? Oh, now I need to run the dishwasher. I need to run a load of laundry. I need to pick up this kid at this time and schedule a date and all of the teeny tiny little things. And I kind of started realizing that that was the only place my brain was really going.
And it really takes up all your brain.
Yeah, it does.
But not in a good way.
Not in a good way.
Yeah.
So I kind of just wanted to force myself to pull myself out of that space, you know, not forget those things, but somehow let go of them and force my brain into other things that felt more productive, more rewarding. And I wanted to see if there would be a way that I can meld the two, still keep the trains running, but also reclaim some of my brain space. So that was kind of what that post was about, what that means to have this mental load, getting rid of some of the guilt of not just holding on to it all the time and taking my brain elsewhere.
Yeah, I really identified with that. And actually, before your blog post came out, had said to a friend one time, just, oh, death by a million inconsequential tasks. That's what I felt my life was.
Yes.
And while I felt totally overwhelmed because I was essentially living and managing three lives, mine and my two kids, and sometimes my husband's also, but I try very hard not to manage his life. Like I try to be like, nope, you're an adult. I'm not going to baby you too. But the way that you said it in your blog post, I loved. It said, changing the expectations for how I use my mind. And using it in a way that is, it's funny, it's not even as overwhelming, but it's much more consequential. And it's almost giving me energy rather than sapping it out of me.
Yeah, with those expectations, I guess what I was thinking about with that was that I feel like some of the expectation as moms, just kind of societal, and, you know, it doesn't come from any one person, like nobody's putting this pressure on me that I'm the one that has to manage it. But it feels like that pressure does sort of come on us. And the expectation is that maybe I shouldn't be focusing on things that I love to do. My brain should be directed in these directions that keep my family life running. And they are, but I feel like I should be able to push back against that a little bit.
Right.
And think about what I want to think about sometimes.
So that's really funny that you just said that, because my next bullet point in my notes was your comment about feeling supported by society. So you just went right through that. How do you feel like you've been able to balance it? Because obviously you said keep the trains running. You obviously can't just abandon the trains.
Right.
But you also need to make room for this other thing in your life that fulfills you mentally and emotionally, spiritually, whatever you want to call it. So how do you do both of those things?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it also has to do with my kids getting a little bit older.
Yeah.
Moving past those toddler stages where everything does sort of just fall on you anyway. But I've started putting a little bit more responsibility on them to manage themselves. And, you know, they can be the one to run and find their toy. And if they lost it, it's
on them.
Kind of, you know, their responsibility. Yeah,
totally. I'm all for that.
Yeah. Remembering things for school, all of those things. So just taking some of those things that I felt like I had to do and giving it back to other people. I think that's a big one. And, you know, that's maybe not helpful for moms who are kind of in the throes of the trenches, I guess.
Right. But I don't feel like the trenches go away. I feel like they just change.
Yeah.
It's different trenches.
It is. It is.
It's like being a referee between the siblings that are having a massive fight over something totally stupid. The whining, the complaining, the I'm bored, that stuff.
Yeah. I feel like people say the problems get bigger, and I think they probably do. My kids aren't maybe quite at that stage yet where
right.
Friend problems and stuff are huge yet. But taking away those tiny little things also helps me feel like I'm better able to focus on some of the bigger stuff that comes along too.
Right. All right. Since we have been talking about being mothers, all of Allison's book recommendations today are books that either deal with motherhood or would be a good gift for mothers since you've got a holiday coming up. So let's go on to Allison's recommendations, and I'll tell you how it's going to go in case we have any new listeners. She's going to start with two old books she loves, two new books she loves, one book she did not love, and then one upcoming release she's excited about. All right, let's do your first old book you loved.
Okay, my first old book that I love is called The Language of Flowers by Vanessa Diffenbaugh. And this is one that I actually think would be a good gift for a mother who likes to read.
I agree.
Honestly, this book, it didn't interest me very much when I saw the title, saw the description.
Wait, this is funny that you just said that, because I reviewed this years ago and I reread it in prepping for this podcast. I said I was not interested at all in reading this book based on the cover, title, or description of the story. Just ignore all that.
Oh my goodness, that's so funny.
I think I also said it seems like the marketing department did not actually want people to read it when they wrote all their materials.
Yeah, I did not find the description very compelling at all. I can't even remember why I picked it up, but I did anyway. It just stands out in my mind as a favorite. It was just really well written, I think. It's about this young woman who is kind of aging out of the foster care system. And she finds this way of connecting with people through flowers. And she finds her way into this job at a flower shop, and she makes recommendations to people for the right flowers to buy based on kind of their Victorian meanings. And it's been a while since I read it, so a lot of the arcs of the plot I've kind of forgotten. But I think what it really is about these characters who she comes across and this woman herself just kind of creating family in these unlikely places. And it's also kind of a look at the foster care system and what happens to these kids who are just aging out. They really don't have a whole lot of support or options.
And they're not quite old enough to really just be released into the world on their own either.
Right, right. They don't really have any means to go to school. They don't really have any
right
work experience, things like that. So they're kind of just let loose. And this character stumbled into a form of family that could kind of support her, but also discovered her own talent and ability to connect with people, even though because of her background, connecting with people in other ways was pretty difficult for her. It does stand out as a favorite, and I have it on another list of books that I want to reread.
Oh, that's high praise.
Yeah.
And I co-signed this one, if you haven't figured that out yet.
Yes.
Yeah, I really liked it too. One of my real life friends, not a Bookstagram person or anything like that, told me to read it. And I did not for quite a while, but I'm glad I did. Actually, I'm not at all into flowers. And I did find that part of the story interesting. It's basically like the Victorian way of communicating through flowers, and each flower has different meanings. And I thought that was interesting, even though I would not have thought I would, based on my total lack of interest in flowers. So that was The Language of Flowers by Vanessa Diffenbaugh. What is the second old book you loved?
So the second one is The Red Tent by Anita Diamond, I believe is how you say her name. And it's maybe not a favorite book, but I just found it to be this really interesting look at women in a time that's not covered very much in historical fiction. It is historical fiction, but it's set during the time of the Old Testament. It's not a religious book. It's more historical. And the main character of this book is named Dina. And she's one of the daughters of the biblical Jacob. Anybody who's familiar with biblical stories, he had a dozen or so sons, including Joseph, who has this coat of many colors. And the sons are really the focus of the biblical stories that we all kind of know. But his daughters and his four wives are really covered less. But this story is about the women in this large family and the lives that they lead, sort of under the radar, this behind the curtain world that these women create with one another. And it's filled with storytelling and traditions and midwifery and kind of all its own little dramas. And The Red Tent refers to where these women would retreat every month during their cycles.
Oh, interesting. I never knew that.
Yeah, they were all kind of there together. And this is where a lot of the storytelling took place, where they weren't underneath the watchful eyes of their husbands or sons or what have you. So it's their kind of their own little world. It's just really fascinating because there's so many women kind of mentioned in the Bible and in history itself who really aren't expanded upon. We don't know much about their stories. And like I said, this isn't a religious book. And I think the author, she probably took some creative license with some of the drama in the book that, you know, if you're a biblical purist or anything, you might take issue with it. But it's really just an interesting look at a time that I don't see covered in fiction very much. And kind of a time that I hadn't given much thought to the lives of women during this time period.
I have not read this one, but I have for many, many years heard wonderful things about it consistently. And I don't know why it's never gone on my list. Maybe because I'm not super into religion, but it sounds like that's not really what it's about. And the other thing that struck me about this book, without having read it, is if you like books told or stories told from a minor character's perspective. So I'm going to actually use a book as an example for this that I hated, but it illustrates the point. So I'm not recommending you go read Circe by Madeline Miller because I hated it. But a lot of other people loved it. However, it takes a very minor female character from Greek mythology and tells a story from her perspective. And it sounds like that might be the same thing that The Red Tent does.
Yeah, very much so. And I didn't look back in a Bible or anything to see how many times Dina is actually mentioned.
Right.
I'm guessing that it might just be, you know, a couple of name drops here and there. And then this author kind of ran with it, realizing that while all this other stuff is going on, these women are living lives too. And I really liked that we got to take a look at what those might have been like.
That's The Red Tent by Anita Diamant.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
But this book is 20 years old, too, and I still hear about it, which says a lot. All right, let's talk about the first new book you love.
The first one is called The Unlikely Adventures of the Shergill Sisters by Bali Kaur Jaswal. So this book is about three British-born sisters, and their Punjabi mother, she dies at the very beginning of the book. And she asks these sisters to take a pilgrimage to India to visit these places that are meaningful to her and spread her ashes. She's got a couple of reasons for this. These sisters are not very close. They don't really get along very well. They're all very different. And they're kind of doing this just out of a sense of obligation. They're trying to get through the trip and back to their lives. So one of the sisters is kind of an authoritarian type figure. She was the oldest and kind of took on that role as children. The other was a rising actress in England who she's kind of been felled very recently by this viral video of her having this meltdown. And she's considered to be a little bit flighty.
Very present day.
Yes. And the third is unexpectedly a traditionalist, and she sought out her own arranged marriage. And she lives in Australia in this arranged marriage, and she's kind of dealing with these pressures back home from her in-laws. So on this trip, they're all dealing with all of these things. They've got this grief about their mother dying, this old bitterness toward one another, plus these different pressures from their lives back home that they're all sort of holding in while trying to manage these relationships with their sisters. And they also want to make sure that they're honoring their mother while they're on this trip. It's just a really great mix of things. It's very smartly written, but it's also pretty light. It's engaging. It's kind of a vivid sense of India. I've never been to India, but I had a great sense of the setting while reading this. And it's also got a little bit of commentary sort of on the state of life for women in India. They get themselves involved in some of these different things that are going on with people who live in India trying to improve the situation for women there. So there's a little bit of that. It's not really too heavy-handed, but, you know, kind of a nod to what life is like there. My sort of sweet spot, especially for this time of the year when things are getting really busy, is light but smart. I feel like I say that a lot in some of my reviews, light but smart. You know, I could read it easily. I think maybe you call it brain candy.
I do call it brain candy. Okay, there's two types of books that, if done well, I love the most, and it's smartly written brain candy and character-driven novels that are just as immersive and page-turning as a really good thriller.
Yes.
And same with you this time of year. This is diverging onto a little bit of a tangent, but people think that summer and the approach to summer, you have all this extra reading time. And I feel like for moms, the opposite is true.
Oh, yeah.
May and September, the end of school and the start of school, I feel like are incredibly hectic for moms. And then in summer, I have a lot less time to myself. So.
Right. And I always feel like it sneaks up on me a little bit in May. So I have a little bit less time. So something like this that's a light but smart keeps me reading and keeps me engaged, but I don't have to think when I'm diving back into it.
Absolutely. And for me, this is important too. I can read something like that in the middle of a chaotic environment, like at the pool.
Yes. Yeah.
And that book is by the author of The Erotic Stories for Punjabi Widows, right?
Yes, it is. And I have not read that one.
Okay.
Part of the reason I picked this up is because I saw that a lot of people really loved that one. So I thought, well, this is here. I'll try the second book.
Yeah. I know nothing about erotic stories other than that it was a Reese Witherspoon pick and a lot of people did really like it, but I have not read it myself. So I'll be interested to see whether she picks this one too. She meaning Reese.
Yeah.
So that was The Unlikely Adventures of the Shergill Sisters by, I should probably let you say this name.
Oh gosh. I'm going to say Bali Kaur Jaiswal.
Awesome. By the time this episode airs, that will have just come out like a week before. April 30th is the release date. All right. What is the second new book you loved?
So the second book I love, and I couldn't resist this one, even though it's Mother's Day, is called Boy Swallows Universe by Trent Dalton. I really loved this book. This is more for moms who don't mind a darker story. So it might be a good fit for you, Sarah.
That would be me.
Yeah. Maybe not your grandma or anything.
Edgy moms.
Yeah. But if you're a mom who likes a darker story, there is a thread of motherhood in this one. So it does fit. So this is about a 12-year-old boy in Australia. His name is Eli, and he lives in this dark world. His mother and his stepfather, both of whom he really loves a lot, they are drug dealers. They're former addicts. He also has this brother named August who doesn't speak, but he has these ways of communicating. And he also seems to kind of have this wisdom about the world and the future. He has a babysitter who is this older man who's a notorious felon in Australia who has escaped from prison multiple times. His name is Slim Halliday. So he's got this kind of crazy life already. And then his parents fall on the wrong side of this drug kingpin in their town. So Eli is sort of left adrift, and he's searching for ways to save them and find them. he's just kind of this wonderful character. He's kind of lost in his own dreams. He wants to be a journalist, but he's also this daring kid and got this sort of casual philosophical outlook on life. And his silent conversations with his brother are entertaining. There's some threads of magic, but they don't sort of overtake the book. Also, some hijinks, and this is where part of the thread of the motherhood came in, where he has this plot to get his mother out of prison, or at least to visit her in prison. So instead of breaking out, he breaks in.
Why would you want to do that?
Yeah, this 12-year-old boy breaking into a prison, a women's prison in Australia. And then there are also, because of the thread of the drug trade throughout this, there's some very, very dark scenes.
Are they graphic and gory type dark?
There is some gore, yes. So they are kind of graphic and gory. And so be warned if those things...
Which is fine for many people, but also not for some.
Right, exactly. But one of the things I found most fascinating about this after I read it is I learned that it's actually based on Dalton's own life.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So his parents were involved in the drug trade. This Slim Halliday character, who is this felon who escaped from prison a bunch of times, was a real person who was his friend, at least. I don't know if he was his babysitter like he was Eli in the book, but there was just a lot of this darkness in his childhood. And I don't know that his childhood, you know, goes as dark as the book goes. But what I've read is that writing this book was kind of his way of processing a lot of that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. His mother, who did spend some time in prison at a younger age, she was kind of involved in the reading and giving her approval of this book and making sure everything was okay and encouraging him to do this, to write this story. I just loved it. It came out in Australia maybe last year. It came out before it did here in the US, and it's gotten a lot of buzz there. I think it's going to get some traction here as well. I think it's really the best book that I've read this year.
And y'all, the Goodreads ratings for this book are astronomically high, 4.5. average rating. That's one of the higher ratings I've seen on Goodreads.
Yeah. And there are definitely some threads that may bother certain readers, you know, the magical thread, kind of an unexplained path that takes, the darkness, and that comes towards the end of the book. But if you can handle those things and just sort of go along with the story, I've seen comparisons to John Boyne.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah, The Heart's Invisible Furies. And I think that's a pretty good comparison. It's definitely a different story, but very much kind of that same feeling when you're reading.
And it's a debut.
Yeah.
Okay, so this book was not on my radar at all prior to getting your email telling me this is what you were going to talk about. And even when I read the synopsis, I was like, that sounds pretty interesting. I've also spent 6 months in Australia, so that part of it's interesting as well. But hearing you talk about it makes me feel like this is right up my alley. And I can't believe I had not heard of it yet.
Yeah, I think you might like it. I'd be really interested to hear what you would think of it, just because there are these various threads. But I think it might be right up your alley as well.
The magic makes me a little nervous because I don't love magic, but it sounds like it's not the main thing.
Yeah, I'm the same way. If I can go along with the rest of it, I can sort of take that.
Yeah.
As it comes. But that's never something that I seek out, I guess.
But I cannot ignore a John Boyne comparison. So that was Boy Swallows Universe by Trent Dalton. And that came out in early April. So by the time this episode comes out, there might be some buzz over on Instagram about this one. Okay, let's turn the corner. Speaking of dark, we're going to stay dark and go to the book you did not love.
So I may raise the ire of some readers, but my book I didn't love is called What Alice Forgot by Leanne Moriarty. I think you and I, Sarah, have chatted briefly about Leanne Moriarty before. And
yes, I'm with you on this one.
Yes, I know a lot of readers love her. So I just kept trying her books for a while. And I have just not really loved any of them.
So how many have you tried?
I think I've read three.
Which ones?
Big Little Lies, which was okay.
Yeah.
And then I read The Husband's Secret, which was also okay. It didn't stick with me.
Okay. So those are the same three that I've read. And I played the three strikes you're out game. So I'm done now.
Yes. I had a couple of others on my shelf and I finally just passed them on to the library.
Yes.
So readers may have already read this one. It's been around for a while. It's about this woman who has an accident at the gym, and she kind of loses her memories of the last 10 years or so. And she wakes up to find that she is a mother and she has kids that she doesn't remember. She's divorcing her husband, who she remembers being, you know, madly in love with. And she doesn't really recognize this suburban mom life that she's leading.
And she's the kind of suburban mom that's like, everything's got to be perfect and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So she's trying to kind of fumble through her life, get her memory back and save her marriage. And I kind of liked the premise of this one. It could be a really interesting story, but I felt like the way it was written, it was sort of just filled with this minutia of daily life, you know, some snarking mom drama. And I remember at one point I kind of sat back and realized that I had just read an entire chapter about they were baking a really large pie at the school or something like that. And I just couldn't believe like there was this whole chapter about this. And this was like the big event in the book. It really didn't resonate with me. I didn't feel like I got a lot of out of the story. And I just wanted more from it, I guess.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I actually feel that way about all three books we talked about of Moriarty's.
Yeah.
I feel like the crushing mommy politics just hides what could be a good story.
Yes.
And I can't take all the mommy politics in the book.
Yeah.
I don't like it in real life, and I don't like it in the book.
I feel like the abundance of mommy politics, which, sure, they happen, but they sort of take away from the potential depth of the characters.
Absolutely.
Because they should be people. They should be, you know, more than their, I guess, need to be perfect at home and at school and in their circle of moms. And I just feel like we never quite get there in a lot of her books.
Yeah. And I also don't find that topic particularly interesting.
Right.
But the other part that bugged me was the woman, I can't even remember her name. She lost her memory because she fell off like a spinning bike in a spinning class. We go through the whole book and there's no sort of medical explanation about what's going on with her memory and her brain. And she visits the doctor once and then just never goes back.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know. I wanted to know what was going on medically in her head, and she didn't address that. All right. That was What Alice Forgot by Leon Moriarty. Let's talk about the upcoming release that you're excited about.
Book I'm looking forward to, and I'm not sure of the release date on this one.
June 4th.
June 4th. Okay, great. On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong. I'm not sure how to say the name. So this is maybe a little bit of a risk for me, but I am looking forward to seeing kind of how it plays out. So it's framed as a letter from a son to a mother, and the mother cannot read. What it says is this son is delving into a family history that happened before his birth, and this was in Vietnam. And he kind of explores these truths about his mother and himself, and he kind of gets into these ideas of identity and race and class and kind of a trauma that is both experienced and also inherited. And I think this idea of inherited trauma is really interesting. So I'm kind of interested to see where that goes. So the author he's actually a poet. I'm not really into poetry at all.
Me neither, but they can write really beautiful prose sometimes.
Exactly. So this has been getting a lot of raves from some really big names who have absolutely loved it. And that doesn't necessarily always mean that it'll work for me, but I'm really interested in seeing how this works. I kind of have always had this deep fascination with Vietnam. I used to read a lot of Vietnam historical fiction in high school, both about the war and also the people of Vietnam.
That's cool. And a departure from the fascination that everyone has with World War II in general.
Exactly. It's kind of been on my mind lately that I've been reading a lot of World War II, but I'd love to get back and read some more books about Vietnam because I had such a deep interest in this, and I think there's a lot to explore there. So I'm really hoping this will all come together in a way that works for me. Like I said, it's a little bit of a risk, but with all these raves, you know, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing how it works.
Do you remember in particular any of the big names that have raved about it?
So Emma Straub is quoted.
Author of Modern Lovers.
Yep. Celeste Ng.
Yep.
Author of Everything I Never Told You and Little Fires Everywhere.
Uh-huh.
Tommy Orange, who wrote There, There.
Which we have talked about on a previous episode of the podcast.
Yes, that's a wonderful book. Marlon James, who I haven't read, but he's got a new one out called Black Leopard, Red Wolf.
And he wrote A Brief History of Seven Killings?
Yes, yes.
Okay, that was his first one that was up for some big award.
Yeah, and I haven't read that one either, but he's kind of been on my list of people to try. Yeah.
Me neither.
Michael Cunningham is the other name that I recognized here, who wrote The Hours.
Oh, okay. Well, those are some big names. I'm curious.
Yeah, and kind of a range of different types of writers as well.
Sure. Well, let me know what you end up thinking about this one once you get to it.
Yeah, I will definitely let you know.
So that one's called On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong, and that's out June 4th. All right. We end every episode by playing a lightning round game called Rate It, and I will throw out five bookish or sometimes I cheat related things to you, and you rate each one either 1 or 5 stars. You cannot use 2, 3, or 4 stars.
Okay.
This is a love-hate game. All right. Number one, Bookstagram.
Oh, one. I'm not on Instagram.
I know that. That's why I put this in here. You are quite possibly the only book blogger that I know that is not on Instagram. Why are you not on Instagram? I'm not pressuring you to say you should be or not be or whatever. But I'm just curious how you came to that decision.
Well, it's not that I don't really want to be. I would like to start at some point. My youngest starts kindergarten in the fall, so I'm hoping maybe I'll have a little bit more time. It's just that I find that I'm not always great at sharing in outlets outside of my blog. You know, Twitter and Facebook, they're not really my strong suits. So I need to get better. And I just feel like Instagram would be maybe another abandoned channel or sort of neglected channel. So
yeah,
I don't want to do it until I can actually focus on it.
I hear you. And I'm on it, but I did not start focusing on it until maybe a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I also find it is a time suck.
Exactly. And I find the blog is enough of it.
Right.
Is enough for me right now. And I do like to look at Instagram and Bookstagram now and then. I'll you know, kind of click through and see what people are sharing there. But,
right.
You know, I think a lot of it is building community and building followers and figuring out, you know, all the ins and outs of it. And it's just not something I want to commit to right now.
Totally. But you do rock Pinterest. So y'all, if you want to follow Allison somewhere other than putting her blog in your feed, go follow her on Pinterest.
Oh, thank you.
And you'll get her great book list. Number two, Evil Mothers of Fiction.
Oh, Evil Mothers of Fiction. 5.
Me too.
I like a good, interesting character, and you don't get a whole lot of evil mothers. I can think of a couple books.
What are your favorite evil mothers?
Well, the one that pops into my head is all about an evil mother, and it's called The Hand That Feeds You, The Hand That Feeds Me.
Oh, yikes. That can be taken to all kinds of meetings with that, with evil mothers in mind.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like the author, and I don't have it in front of me, I feel like the author might be AJ somebody.
Okay.
Kind of about this narcissistic mother who just sort of worms her way into her kids and her husband's minds, and it's dark. It's been a few years since I read it, so I don't remember a lot of details, but she was definitely the first one that popped into my head.
I'll look up the author name and put it in the show notes for everybody. And the first mother I think of when I think of evil mothers of fiction is, now I'm blanking on her name, the mother in Flowers in the Attic.
Oh, yeah.
And the grandmother, too. Throw them both in there.
Right.
Corinne.
Yes, yes.
Yes, that's it. God, what an evil mother.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing like locking your kids in the attic for their entire childhood.
Oh, those books were so bad, but you just couldn't put them down, right?
So bad and so good.
And they're making a mini series of one of the other series, not the Flowers in the Attic, the Heaven series.
Oh, I read that one too. I read all of her books when I was a kid.
Yeah. I can't remember what station, but it's coming.
Okay. I'll keep an eye out for that. I'll try to find it and link to that in the show notes as well. My mom, I used to read all these V.C. Andrews when I was a kid, and I remember she finally picked up, I can't remember which one, maybe it was Flowers in the Attic, but she read one of them and was so beyond horrified that that's what I'd been reading all this time.
I think I had the same thing happen. Yeah,
I know, right? And I really haven't changed because I still read really, really dark stuff, and she still will read my blog and be like, I don't understand how you read this dark, dark, crazy stuff. All right, number three, motherhood memoirs.
I'd say 5 if they're well done and I can feel like I can relate to them.
Absolutely.
I don't read a lot of them.
Yeah.
Here, I like your designation of women who get women.
Oh, yes. Thank you. I was going to mention that at the end of the episode. So thanks for doing it now.
Yeah. But, you know, they sort of have reflections that, you know, I can relate to and things that I've experienced. I don't know that a straight, you know, memoir of the years of motherhood, but I kind of like the essay format.
Absolutely. The ones that stand out for me are people like Anna Quinlan, Kelly Corrigan, and most recently, Mary Laura Philpott, who will be coming on the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I like authors that take some sort of vague thing I've been feeling and put it into perfect words where I'm like, oh, yes, wait, that's how you say it. And that's me.
Exactly. Yes.
So Mary Laura Philpott most recently wrote, I Miss You When I Blink. And it is an essay collection. And it definitely addresses sort of finding your identity through motherhood, finding satisfaction amid the mundane tasks of life, all that stuff.
Yeah, I need to read that one. I've seen a lot of good things about it.
I think you'd like it. All right, number four, Big Little Lies, the TV show.
Oh, one, I haven't watched it.
Oh, okay. So given what you said about Leon Moriarty's books, I think you'll like the TV show. I did. I loved the TV show, and I did not like Big Little Lies, the book.
Yeah.
And I think it's because the show really did focus on the adults and their very real issues they were having rather than letting the mommy politics overshadow all that.
Oh, okay.
It's much darker.
Okay. I kind of shied away from it just because I wasn't that interested in the books.
Yeah. And I felt the same way. And then some of my friends were like, no, you have to give this a try.
Okay.
But I did feel like the mommy politics was way less prevalent.
Oh, good. Okay. And they're doing additional seasons beyond just what was covered in the book, right? Okay.
Yeah. So I'm really excited about that. I'm excited to see where the story goes because there's no precedent for it.
Right.
All right. Number five. This is departing from books, sticking with motherhood. Mother's Day brunch.
Oh, one.
Ooh, me too.
Taking my kids out to brunch, that's not relaxing right now.
I feel like that's a tradition that might be going by the wayside a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I think I enjoyed it when we were older kids and we took my mom out for brunch, you know?
Right. That's different. I remember Mother's Day a couple years ago, there was an editorial in the New York Post that talked about how awful Mother's Day brunch is for mothers because of everything we talked about at the beginning of this episode, the mental load. It's sort of just expected that the mothers manage the children, even if people have a delineated duties, if you will, between the mom and the dad. It ends up being the mom who's sitting at the table, like getting on their kids about their manners and sitting still and whatever.
Yeah.
Just how it's such a just backslap to moms to force them to go do this on Mother's Day, a day that is supposed to celebrate them.
Yeah. And I feel like there's all this pressure around it too, you know, get the reservation and get there on time.
Getting dressed up, getting the children dressed up.
Yeah, it's just more pressure and more stress than it's really worth.
I agree. All right. Tell everybody where they can find you online.
So I am at mindjoggle.com. I'm on Twitter occasionally. You can find links to social media on my website.
Okay. I also have a couple motherhood-related blog posts that I'm going to link to in the show notes. One Allison mentioned earlier, it's called Women Who Get Women, and it's mostly nonfiction, not all nonfiction, but books that I feel like were written by people that truly understand women's lives. And then I also have a list called Books That Would Make Great Gifts for Moms. And if you need a last-minute Mother's Day gift, check that out. And I'll also link to Allison's post on the mental load as well. Next week, we have our third special episode of the year. Catherine from Gilmore Guide to Books, who has joined me quarterly for all of my preview episodes, is going to be coming back to do the summer book preview. And I feel like we just did spring, so it's kind of crazy that this has already rolled around. But we will be covering new books that we're excited about coming out in June and July. Talk to you next week. Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions, especially since we're just starting out. Find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at Sarah's Shelves, on Instagram at Sarah's Bookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. Happy reading!